I'm Scott Glazer, and this is Backstage Atlanta. Today I'm speaking with songwriter, producer, and arranger Jerry Ragavoy. He started producing in his hometown of Philadelphia in the early 1950s. Ragavoy's first hit song, co-written with Burt Burns, was Cry Baby, which was a hit in 1963. His songs have been recorded by the Rolling Stones, The Who, Janis Joplin, and soul singers Irma Thomas, Howard Tate, Lorraine Ellison, and Irma Franklin. Janis Joplin especially liked Ragavoy's songs and recorded classic versions of Cry Baby, Piece of My Heart, and Try Just a Little Bit Harder. Jerry Ragavoy lived in Atlanta for 12 years and has recently moved back to his former home, New York City. Jerry, welcome to Backstage Atlanta. Do you remember writing your first song?
Yes. Let's see, I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And at that time, when I was probably from the time of six or seven, all I ever listened to was classical music.
Were there musicians in your house?
My mother was very talented musically, and my uncle, who passed away probably 20 years ago, he was a very well-known songwriter, so it must be in the genes.
Really? What was his name?
Joseph Miro, and he wrote You Make Me Feel So Young.
Oh, wow.
You know, the Frank Sinatra one?
Of course.
And he wrote a lot for the movies. He had a lot of, a reasonable amount of hit songs.
Did you know then, when you started writing your songs at such a young age, that you wanted to spend the rest of your life writing and arranging
songs?
Well,
it was my chief interest. But I learned very early on, when I wrote my first song, that it was sort of a ripoff of the Nutcracker Suite, Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. And I learned very early on, obviously, that in the music business, that's what you do. You rip off things. It's called creative plagiarism.
And now, who has influenced you lyrically?
That one I'm not really sure of. In a very general way, my chief influences were music, not lyrics. And I think the lyrics, my guess would be, it's a fairly personal kind of thing. Now, I don't know if that applies to lyric writers in general, so I can only speak for myself. I write lyrics. It's a statement. It's not an abstraction, such as music is. You know, it's in the air. You can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't smell it. It's a pure abstraction. It goes in your ear and you get a visceral reaction, either negative or positive.
And how do you generate melodic ideas to go with your lyrics? Do you play chord progressions?
My opinion is you have the gift or you don't. Today's world, there are millions of songwriters who don't have the gift, but they do have an understanding of the loop.
A lot of songwriters say that, like you're saying, songs are a gift that come from somewhere else, and
a totally unknown quantity. That's my opinion.
Do you ever use, like, say, maybe a rhyming dictionary or something like that when you work?
Once in a while I do. If I get stuck for a rhyme, I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they do publish rhyming dictionaries, and you look through them and you say, let's see, what rhymes with pig? And you find out you have a Russian aircraft, MiG.
And that might take you in another direction?
The question of how does one write songs is virtually impossible to transmit to anybody. It comes from within. You don't know why it comes. You don't know why. Melodies pop into your mind. Or if you're banging on the piano, there is no structure, there is no formula. In today's world, there is formulas because you have a computer. But I don't come from that school. It's self-generated. I don't have to go to some computer and work out a loop and create a song.
Is there any situation that encourages, for you, songs to come through? Like some writers have to be completely alone with the phone off and everything?
I don't know. It's hard to answer. They come from anywhere.
Do you have a daily songwriting regimen?
No, I have nothing like that.
So an idea may come into your head. Do you write it down immediately, or do you just kind of store it for later?
Well, there were different times. You know, I'm of the age where I come from a very earlier period, before the tape recorder, before computers and all of that. So if I did get an idea and I didn't want to forget it, I would write it down. I can write music. I'm an arranger. I can orchestrate. I can do all that stuff.
Do you write your songs from beginning to end, or do you change the order of sections later on?
Everybody's trying to find the secret of musical creativity, and no one will ever find it. It's not a mathematical formula. You do this, and you do that, and you produce X. It doesn't work that way. At least it doesn't work that way with me. And I think music critics in particular try to find the secret of musical creativity, and they'll never find it. But what you have is musicologists who define a formula because they don't know what else to do because they're not musicians, and they don't get it.
Do you ever feel restricted by certain song forms?
No, I never think of song forms. It creates its own form. In classical music, you have descriptions, fast, slow, or they'll say interlude, they'll say this, they'll say that.
Sure.
All of it is when a talented composer writes something, he doesn't say, I'm going to write an interlude, or I'm going to write this form or that form. I think I'll write a sonata. I think I'll write this or that. I think of the great composers, whether it be pop or classical. I don't think they think of that at all. They just write it, and they leave it to some critic to define it.
Somebody analyzes it afterward.
Yeah, after the fact.
Sure. Let me see. You spent 12 years in Atlanta working and writing down here and putting materials together. How was Atlanta as far as an environment to do your work?
I don't know that Atlanta, New York, Cleveland, Rochester, I don't think it makes a difference. If you have a musical expression, you just can write it anywhere.
Great. I know you employed a lot of the great musicians around here. And of course, everybody who worked with you really appreciated and loved the experience.
Well, they're good musicians there. The guys I worked with, you know, I always thought to myself, after moving to Atlanta, what the hell am I going to do? You talk about New York studio musicians, and you got to remember, I came to life in the music business in the late 60s. Middle 60s, where there were no computers, no drum machines, no anything. You hired a real band. Some of the studio musicians I worked with for about 30 years are, to me, some of the most memorable experiences I ever had and will ever have. Because you're talking about great studio musicians. They were brilliant, absolutely brilliant. It was a joy to work with these guys and hear your arrangements played back by these guys.
Anybody in particular come to mind?
They were all great, every single one of them.
You're talking about Philadelphia session players, New York players?
I'm talking New York. There were some good guys in Philly, but in New York, the standard is very high, extremely high. For example, my first experience in New York writing an arrangement that included strings, well, I found out after the session was over, the string players played under Toscanini every Saturday, the NBC Symphony. It was, what is that?
That's rarefied company.
Sure is. And that's true, by the way, in Los Angeles. All of those great, great musicians who played in the movies, and in those days, the 40s, 50s, 30s, they had these 100-piece orchestras playing for the movies.
Good days of employment for musicians back then. Let me see. Let's talk a little bit about some of the folks you've worked with and the work that you've done for them. First of all, how does a young guy from Philadelphia start writing soul hits and become tied in with such great soul singers as Howard Tate, Irma Thomas, and on into Janis Joplin, etc.? Tell me about the story.
Well, I'll tell you, R&B, you know, recalling what I said a few minutes ago, I would say I spent from the age of 6 or 7, I forget, all the way up to my early teenage years, 14, 15, all I listened to was classical music. I didn't listen to the radio all that much. Sort of in my teenage years, I started listening to the radio, all the pop songs. And pop songs in those days are described in Billboard today as jazz. You know, Richard Rodgers, George Gershwin, you know, Victor Young, et cetera, and on, that great period in musical history of the 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, until Elvis came along.
How times have changed.
You had just incredible pop music. Rodgers and Hart, you know, and so forth and so on. Even my uncle, writing You Make Me Feel So Young. Right. So you had great, I really got interested in those guys when in my early teenage years. They were the pop songs of my day.
Right, that was the music that everybody was listening to.
Now Bill Bird says Stardust, jazz.
So you started writing these songs after...
Well, the reason I write R&B, and let me just tell you that very quickly, is when I was about 21, I was about 18 or 19, I got a job in a record shop in an all-black neighborhood. I heard, in those days they called them race records. So I was working at, you know, 50, 60 hours a week in a record shop, listening to nothing but gospel, jazz, and whatever was R&B pop and blues like John Lee Hooker. I heard all the great gospel music, which really was an eye-opener for me. Gospel music is really hit me very hard. I think it's unbelievable idiom.
Rhythmically or lyrically or melodically, just all of the above?
You know, it's the whole ball. It's not, doesn't come in pieces. It fuses together and produces an effect. It could be lyrics, it could be this, it could be that. But the music, to me, was extraordinary. And it really made a major influence. I was not born to write R&B. I come from a middle-class family, have nothing to do with black music. And suddenly I'm thrust into a record shop for 3 or 4 years, listening to nothing but black music. That's all I heard. And I do not believe I would be able to write some of the things I've written in the R&B world without having that record shop experience. And it wasn't that it was a conscious borrowing of the idiom, so to speak. It was more osmosis. You were there. It became part of you. And it still is.
So maybe the spirit of that music carried over into you and what you started doing.
I say it wasn't a conscious effort. It wasn't anything that I wanted, that I was looking to analyze. All you did was take it like a sponge and absorb it, and with no premeditated intention involved.
So you started writing these songs. How did you hook up with your first soul singer?
By default, and more by accident than on purpose, in Philadelphia in this record shop, in an all-black neighborhood, it was very common for groups of guys, sometimes girls or guys and girls, would be out on the corner singing doo-wop. You know, they just would be singing. Sometimes I'd walk outside and listen to them, and, you know, some of them were good, some of them were terrible, and all that. But one day I walked out, and I hear this group singing this song. And I said to myself, that's a hit song. Now, having worked in the record shop for 2 years and listening to all those records that made it and those that failed, you sort of got a sense of what could be a hit song. Anyway, my boss, who happened to be a friend of mine as well, I said, you know, his name was Herb Slotkin. Mm-hmm. To this day, we still talk every so often, 50 years later.
Incredible.
I said, Herb, you ought to start a label. I mean, he had the money. I had no money. And I said, I'm going to bring a group in the store. I want you to hear this song. I'm telling you, it's going to be a hit record. Let's cut it. So the group walked in, sang the song, and he wasn't as, you know, musically inclined. He just relied on my opinion. And he said, okay, well, let's go do it. So I cut this song, and it was a group called the Castells. And it was a hit record.
Wow.
The first record I ever made. It was a doo-wop record, and I can't stand doo-wop.
Obviously, a lot of people did like it, though.
Oh, a lot of people did. I just never liked it. To this day, if I hear it, I turn it right off.
What was the first song you wrote that someone took and made a hit of?
No one took a song of mine and made a hit out of it. I made my own hits. What
was the first hit song you wrote?
The first hit song I wrote and produced, which was really best described by saying hardly came from the heart. It was a mechanical construction of a song that I believe the market needed, and I tailored it. It wasn't an emotional experience for me. It was really a mechanical work. I said, if I do this and that and do that and that, I think that should work, and it might help it become a hit. So it really wasn't from the soul. It was really, I guess the best word I can think of is a mechanical musical experience. And it turned out to be a top, I think it went to number 12 or 13 on the charts, I forget. A thing called A Wonderful Dream. And the group was called The Majors.
Fantastic. How about the singer Howard Tate? How did you become involved with him?
Well, I was producing Garnet Mims at the time, I had a couple hits with him.
What were your hits with Garnet Mims?
Crybaby went to number 3, sold about 1.5 million records. It was my song, I produced the record, and from there I just kept on producing.
And people started coming to you?
Yeah, that's what happens. You have a hit record and everybody thinks you're a genius.
So it was from that point you started working with Howard Tate?
And well, with the group Garnet Mims, they knew Howard Tate, and one of the guys in the group said, you ought to listen to this guy, which I did. And I thought he had a very, very outstanding voice. With Howard Tate, I listened carefully to him to see what his sound was like or what his soul was like, and I sort of created a style for him. Because the style that you hear on Howard Tate was totally and completely created by me. He never sang that way to begin with. And I worked very hard with him, going up, going down, sideways.
And the general public probably doesn't realize the role of a producer.
Well, there's different kind of producers. I'm an arranger, producer, writer. And then there are producers who are not musicians who go in and produce a record. They hire musicians, and the musicians do it, and the producer walks away with the credit. And producers comes in many forms.
How about the New Orleans singer Irma Thomas?
Terrific. And I should add, a terrific lady. I really care about her a lot.
I saw her perform several years ago at the opening of the Hard Rock Cafe down in New Orleans, and she put on a great performance.
She's terrific. And a nice lady. What a nice lady.
How did you first become involved with her?
I became involved with her because I didn't produce the record, although I wrote the song. Time is on my side.
Right.
And shortly thereafter, the Rolling Stones heard it, liked it, and they recorded it. And that was their first hit in this country.
It's a great song.
It treated me well. Whether it's a great song or not, I'm not sure of that.
You're listening to Backstage Atlanta. I'm Scott Glazer, and today I'm speaking with songwriter Jerry Ragavoy, the writer behind many soul hits over the years, including Janis Joplin's Piece of My Heart, Try Just a Little Harder, Cry Baby, Get It While You Can, and this next cut, Time Is On My Side, performed here live by New Orleans singer Irma Thomas.
Be free one of these days, baby. No, and it won't be long. Oh, all of my worries will be over. Time is on my side. Yes, it is. Yeah, time is on my side. Yes, it is. Yeah, you're searching for good times.
That might be one of the fastest songs I ever wrote. I think I wrote it in a half hour.
Would you say that some of your best songs are songs that the public never hears?
No question about it. My favorite songs are still running around my apartment.
That's interesting. Well, you never know what folks are going to like.
Well, there's always that dichotomy, so to speak, I guess, within any writer. The songs that they are so close to and are proud of never get recorded. My first experience, going back to Wonderful Dream, when I was peddling the record, now this is a true story, I got turned down by everybody. I mean, in those days there were a lot of independent labels. Right now we have corporate America dictating what we hear. But I was turned down, this Wonderful Dream record. And I remember one company in particular. Well, I don't know, Jerry, it doesn't sound any like anything out there. I said, you got that right. Not supposed to.
It's hard to set a trend, isn't it?
Well, most people who own record companies or are head of record companies operate on a success formula.
Right.
And if they hear what's on the charts, and if it doesn't sound like something that's on the charts, they don't know how to deal with it.
People like to hear things they're comfortable with, maybe?
Well, I always had a credo, and it may be very derogatory to myself, but the heads of companies generally create nothing, copy everything, and if they can't copy it, they buy you out.
And so goes commerce.
Yep, it's the way it is.
Let me ask you about Janis Joplin. She performed so many of your songs, and she obviously had a real thing for your writing, Jerry. Piece of My Heart.
Whatever the case, it is. She did. She recorded five of my songs.
Piece of My Heart, Try Just a Little Bit Harder.
Get It While You Can.
Cry Baby.
Cry Baby, and another one called My Baby. I don't know how she recorded that. To this day, I still hate that song. I can't believe I wrote it.
How did you feel when sort of a next generation artist got a hold of your songs and really ran with them?
I didn't feel bad, I'll tell you that.
Well, that's good. Did you know Janis Joplin?
I only met her once.
Any impressions of her?
A friend of mine who I knew in New York moved to San Francisco in the 60s and somehow hooked up with Janis Joplin. He wasn't a musician. He was more or less an engineer and things like that, and a very good one at that. But anyway, one day, Janis was appearing at Madison Square Garden, and I don't know whether you know this. I'm the founder of the Hit Factory.
I did not know that. I congratulate you on the Hit Factory's run. Did it close recently?
Yeah, it closed a few months ago. 4 months ago. I don't remember.
And what an appropriate name for that place. It certainly did produce the hits.
I had it for 7 years. I sold it in 1975. I only opened the studio for myself. I had to give it a name, and I was only for my own productions. I really didn't start it for a business because studio time was tough to get a hold of. And I said, I'm going to just build my own little studio so I won't have to go through trying to book time and waiting 2 weeks and this and that and so forth. Because the 60s, the beginning of that rock era with the Beatles.
Sure.
Everybody was running into the studio. So I built it for myself, and the word got out by the musicians I was using, my guys, telling everybody how great the Hit Factory sounds. And I surely didn't plan it that way. I just put it up. I didn't have any pretty furniture. It was just a little dumpy place, and the only thing I concentrated was on the sound. I didn't care. I wasn't in the commercial recording business. I don't know. The word got out, and suddenly, after about 6 months or thereabouts, we started getting booked day and night.
Who were some of the groups that had hits cut?
Gee whiz. Well, one of the big ones was The Band.
One of my favorites.
And I forget the name of the album. It was the brown cover.
I know some of
it. I think it's called The Band. I think that's what it was.
Robbie Robertson.
I was at their session.
What do you think of Robbie Robertson as a songwriter?
I think he's terrific.
It's amazing the flavor, the American flavor to their music.
It was a very unique sounding group. The material was terrific. The arrangements were terrific. When I stopped by some of their sessions, just hanging out, listening, I said, boy, these guys are unbelievable. I love the way Levon played drums. He was solid as a rock.
It's amazing how each one of the vocalists in the band and instrumentalists had a real personality on his instrument and on his...
Well, whatever the case may be, they were just one hell of a band.
Absolutely. I guess the most...
Edgar Winters, Jonathan Winters, Roberta Flack, Carly Simon, James Taylor. I mean, it went on and on and on.
It's a heck of a list.
And the end of the story is, we were so busy, I found myself being an administrator rather than a writer. And I surely didn't want to go out in this life as a recording studio owner. And I said, I got to get out of here because this is interfering with my creativity.
Sure.
So I sold it.
I guess the most recent album I've seen cut at the Hit Factory is the release a couple of months ago by the jazz pianist Bill Charlap, who's a New York guy with...
I happen to hear his album.
How did you like it?
It was nice. Very nice.
Album of Gershwin tunes. Let me ask you one more question. Anybody out there today that you're really enjoying whose work is interesting to you?
I happen to love Chris Botti's album. I love it to death.
The jazz trumpeter, Chris Botti.
Right.
For the melodies or the sound, anything in particular?
Everything.
Everything.
The whole album is great to me.
Fantastic.
I love Diana Krall. And there's a lot of stuff that I, for some reason, I don't know why, and often there would be no way possible to explain this. I find myself listening to stuff that started with me when I was a teenager. I am a total jazz nut. And if you listen to my arrangements, like on Howard, for example, you hear the horn arrangements, you know where they come from. You know, it's, I discovered jazz in the early 50s. I used to go to all the clubs. I've seen Charlie Parker. I've seen all those greats. You know, I used to go all the time. I mean, jazz made a very serious impression on me.
And Philadelphia had a vibrant scene, and of course, New York is the scene, too.
Well, New York is an amazing place. I mean, the diversity, you see, with all due respect to Atlanta, I mean, it's really the main source appears to be hip-hop to me.
Yes.
I don't dislike hip-hop. Some of it I find really terrific. But I miss the diversity of New York.
Right.
Where if you want to go see hip-hop, you can see it. You want to see great jazz, you can see it. You want to go to hear great classical music or opera, you have the Metropolitan, you have Lincoln Center, you have these great jazz clubs. I happened to see Chris Botti about a month ago. He was appearing at the Blue Note.
Great.
And my wife, you know, loves that record, and she said, oh, we got to go see Chris. I said, sure. So I go down there, and there's his group, you know, four or five pieces, and there's an old buddy of mine playing keyboard.
Fantastic.
Guy that I've used many times.
Who was playing keyboards?
Cliff Carter.
Wow.
And, you know, very talented musician.
Well, I wish you much success in New York, continued success, rather, and all the best to you up there. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I am flattered, you know, that you wanted me on your show, and it was good talking to you as well.
Backstage Atlanta is produced at the studios of WMLB. Our production director is Catherine Davis. This is your host, Scott Glazer.